Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 26 of the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me this week is not Jared Kimber, he's on vacation. And Mark Machado, who you might know from the Daily Mail or the BBC or the Murali End podcast on YouTube, he will be joining me, making his debut in the Kimberverse. So welcome, Mark. How do you feel?
Oh, well, I assume what happened, Behram, is that you called every other cricket person you know and no one answered. And I picked up my phone and that's how I've ended up here. But it's a great honour and privilege to be sitting in for the great man.
To be fair, though, it's only because we had drinks like a day earlier. So you were the first person that came to mind. And I was like, okay, let's have Mark sub for Jared. Because Estelle is also in Dambulla right now, covering the Asia Cup, which we will be talking about later. We also have Uncle Shah, Babar Azam, Abdul TS and Mookie in the comments section. So hello to you guys. Lots to talk about, of course, in today's Overthrows podcast. And we'll start off with the ongoing test series played between the West Indies and England in England. And England have defeated the West Indies by 241 runs at Trent Bridge to take an unassailable 2-0 lead in the series. But Mark, the visitors competed far better in Nottingham than they did at Lord's.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real shame how it could have ended yesterday on Sunday. Because I did think that actually when they came into bat in that fourth innings, I was like, maybe we might see something special over here. It started quite well for them. The openers put on a bit of a stand, and then once one wicket fell, it all kind of fell apart super quickly. But you're right to point out, Behram, they definitely did kind of fight back much better than they did at Lord's. I mean, there's so much to talk about in terms of the difference between how the two teams are allowed to prepare for test cricket, how much test cricket the two teams get to play, how, you know, the kind of roots into playing red ball cricket and what the kind of future might be if you're a young professional cricketer in the West Indies, deciding which formats you might want to specialise in and what kind of economic pressures you might find yourself under not to play red ball cricket. And I think, you know, we're going to... In England, we'll probably end up talking about this all summer because, you know, my beloved Sri Lanka team are kind of up next. And I'm not entirely sure how that's going to go, though I think they're probably a bit more experienced in terms of red ball cricket, this squad that's coming over. So, lots to talk about from it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously West Indies did defeat Australia at the Gabba not too long ago, but that too was a surprise result. It was one of the beautiful moments of cricket in 2024. And we can't expect that to become the norm because they don't play a lot of test cricket, right? And it's quite complicated in that regard. But there was a time, after the first session on day three where the West Indies posted a lead of 41 runs and the test match was very much alive. So at least we got to see some good competition in this particular game, which wasn't there at Lord's. Of course, I was myself there at Lord's, you know, in the flesh. And in a way, I was happy that test match ended in 3 days because I got extremely sick by day three. But I'm happy to see the West Indies compete far better at Trent Bridge. Also, we have lots of performers to talk about. So many people scored runs in this game. I want to start with Joe Root. He smashed 122 in the third innings and that was his 32nd test stun. He is now at 11,940 test runs. He's 33 years old. England play a shitload of test cricket and he's now less than 4,000 runs away from Sachin Stally. He's currently the 8th highest scorer of all time in the format and he can potentially become the highest scorer in the format. Do you think that'll happen?
I think there's no doubt he's going to end up there, right? He's going to end up kind of top 3 or 4 if he can stay injury free with the amount of test cricket that England play. I think, you know, we touched upon how the West Indies haven't been as competitive this time as they have been maybe kind of a few decades ago. We talked about how test cricket, we haven't talked about it yet, but it's a kind of continuing theme with any kind of cricket conversation about how test cricket isn't as competitive as it once was. Joe Root has hit that real sweet spot of being, you know, one of England's greatest all-time batters in an era where the teams that they're playing around them are really struggling to play test cricket in England, right? He's almost guaranteed to play at least kind of 8 at least kind of 6 to 8 test matches in England for basically as long as he wants for the next 5 or 6 years, right? So you kind of think he's probably going to get those records, right? Even if he goes abroad, even if he goes away to the Ashes or goes to Pakistan later this year and he kind of falls apart all over the place, you'd still think his home record is going to be good enough to get him through. Like, I thought looking at those stats when all the tables came out was really interesting, right? Because you look at the other players when they've got their runs and it's at a much more healthier time for Test cricket, right? I think, you know, as a Sri Lanka fan, we often get criticised mainly from Australians about Murali's record, 800 wickets, talking about, you know, who did he get them against, when did he get them against, what were the conditions. I think the same is going to have to be levelled at a lot of the players who are getting test records now. I'm not saying there's going to be an asterisk. I'm not saying Root isn't a great player. He is a great player. But I think that's going to be, you know, one of those things that's constantly brought up to him. It's not a great era for test cricket, but it's a great era to be a very good batsman if you play from the big three.
Yeah, I do understand that the sheer volume of games that England get, that too versus top opposition, is, you know, there's a disparity there with respect to other nations. So Root is already at 142 test matches, whereas someone like, for instance, Babar Azam would be lucky to get to 100 test matches, right? I get that, but then also I feel like playing your home cricket in England and averaging, what is it now, 49.95? This is an obsession of mine. After every test match that Joe Root plays, I will go and check his average. And he is, again, you know, hovering close to that golden number of 50. And I feel like he is one of England's best batters of all time and one of the best batters that test cricket has ever seen. 32 test runs is also no joke. And his conversion rate has gotten a lot better in recent times. I remember that used to be an issue for Joe Root, right? And now he's reverse ramping it and everything. England, let's suppose if they play around about 15 test matches per year. They probably end up playing more, but let's say it's 15, right? Joe Root plays for 4 years and plays every single test match, does not get injured, plays 60 more test matches that way, gets to 202 tests. I think he surely, you know, crosses Sachin at that point. I feel like that's a given. And even if he doesn't cross Sachin, he'll definitely end up as the second highest run scorer in test cricket, unless he has a shock retirement, which I honestly don't see coming. And I mean, to score less than 4,000 runs in 60 test matches for a player of Root's caliber seems very, very doable. But I understand the asterisk conversation as well. It's just that Root has gotten to play some quality attacks on different difficult conditions as well. So I feel like it kind of evens things out.
The other two things that are worth talking about when you talk about Joe Root getting test runs is I kind of feel Bazball was kind of designed for him, right? Because it was designed to kind of keep a clear path for him to be the record or to make as many runs as possible. And it kind of takes the whole kind of environment that Baz McCullum and Ben Stokes are building around it is designed to take pressure off batters, really. So it's about going out there and expressing yourself. Because I think there was a stage where I think particularly the back end of his captaincy when he felt a lot of pressure and you could feel he was batting with pressure. It always felt like he was batting with pressure because he felt like he had to get the runs. I think that's kind of faded away. I also think the emergence of Harry Brooks quite interesting as well, right? Because that's another batter that people are looking at and going, he could be one of the all-time greats. He's got all the skill set. You know, he looks like a baby Root. He's got a skill set where he could go on and get runs for the next kind of 15 years for England. And I think that kind of, to a degree, kind of takes the pressure off him as well, right? Because he knows it's not, he's not the guy that they're looking at to get runs. There's more runs available in the team. How often, when you look at that list of great batters or test, you know, the highest test scorers, how often do you see, look at the teams that they played in and think, oh yeah, but that team also had loads of other great batters around them. And kind of kept it. It's very rare that it's just that all the runs are collected by one person. So, you know, it's a really good time to be Joe Root bearer. I think that's the whole point of this conversation, right?
It's also a great time to be Harry Brook, who you mentioned. He's only played 14 test matches, sure, but he scored nearly 1,400 runs. He's got 500s in that. He scored 36 and 109 in this test match. He is billed to be the next big thing as far as England batters are concerned. I do feel like he's not as complete a batter as Joe Root. He camps on his back leg a lot more and plays from like deep in his crease. So it's a different mold of batter and he's more, you know, tailor-made for Bazball than Root. Root has had to evolve and I feel like Root's evolution too, you know, pays homage to the good side of baseball. Of course, there's the cultish side of baseball as well, but we're not going to get into that again today. That probably requires another podcast on its own, which I think we've even done. I think Jared and I have done a Footmarks on that at some point. But Brook, again, another ton for him. He was out of Test cricket for a bit, of course, because of the loss of his grandmother. And he seems to be in a good mental state now. He's back to scoring runs. This is a pretty big season for him because England will play him in every single Test match, won't they?
Yeah, they absolutely will. I think with Harry Brook, because we saw him, he did have an IPL contract, right? I wonder if there's a, like, he's still, you know, he's still very young. He's still, it's still early in his career. I wonder if we might see him focus on the other formats as he gets a little bit older. You know, if I was involved in the England Test setup, that would be my bigger worry, is that, you know, as you say, he's very good, but it still looks like you can see his technique's going to grow and he's going to get more comfortable playing Test cricket. But I wonder if we see him specialise in T20 cricket later on and pause playing it. Only because, you know, the amount of money that is on offer in T20 cricket now, I think it's kind of almost irresistible for anyone.
I get that. It is definitely irresistible, but England are the sort of board who would compensate a player to focus on Test cricket. So if they want Harry Brook to play more Test cricket, I don't think he'll have that big of an issue with that, particularly with that record that he has right now, averaging more than 62 runs. Sure, it's only 14 Test matches, but he does seem like a very, very good talent. Whether he's a generational talent or not, I feel like that is the bit that remains to be seen. We're not doubting his hitting ability, but I do think there are a few chinks in his armor. Let's see if someone is able to exploit those or if he's able to build further on his game, which is very likely, of course, because he's only 25 years old. He is, you know, a developing batter. So sky's the limit for him, I suppose. But Joe Root is literally like a behemoth right now. So getting to his level would require some time. Moving forward, of course, there were other performers with the bat for England. I really want to talk about Ben Duckett. He was playing at his home ground, of course, and he scored 71 and 76 in this game. And for someone, Mark, who leaves only 2% of the deliveries he faces in Test cricket, his average is over 41 runs per dismissal in 22 Test matches, which I find quite impressive because it's high-risk cricket and averaging over 40 for a Test match opener is very stellar. And Duckett makes it look easy at times.
I think what I really like about Ben Duckett and the way he bats is that obviously he's kind of had a kind of false start to his Test career previously, right? Is that he's kind of gone away, he's rethought it. So for me, Beryl, my kind of personal theory is that I think to be a top international player playing for one of the top sides, you have to get your head right, right? It's all in the head. There's absolutely nobody, one of the major Test player nations, in the kind of, you know, I'm talking about the top 9 or 10 countries to play Test cricket. There's nobody who ever gets on the field who doesn't have the skill set to succeed if they need to. What the difference is, the difference between the really top players and the inconsistent international players is getting your head right. And I think that's what Ben Duckett's got, right? We say he plays high-risk cricket. We know that kind of aligns with what baseball wants.
Yep.
But there's two things that happen. He's happy with himself to play that game. That's his natural game. That's, you know, that's how he wants to play, and that's really important to him. But also, he's empowered by the coaching team to go and play like that, right? There's nobody telling him, you need to leave more balls. You need to, this is Test cricket. There's 5 days to score runs. You don't need to score for every ball. They're letting him play his natural game, and it's you know, even the, you know, the people who least like England in the world have got to be happy to see talented players thrive, right? Because that's what we watch the game for, right?
Absolutely. And I've quite liked Ben Duckett, you know, for a while. Now he even played a bit in the PSL, was quite impressive over there. But his resurgence in the Test team under, you know, Stokes and McCullum has been a story. We've also done a Footmarks on that, actually. I think it's called Duck It Never, because he doesn't leave anything, right? And we all know he is an elite sweeper of the ball, right? He can play all four kinds of sweep shots. And on slow and low turners, you'd want a player like Ben Duckett in your team. But in this Test match, what I was particularly impressed with was his offside play. And they even did like a few segments on it in the broadcast where they showed how if it was a bit short, he would cut it. If it was full, he would drive it. And they were also showing his dismissals in the Ashes series where Australia bowled similar lengths and lines to him. Maybe a bit tighter than the West Indies, but he was falling prey to those sort of deliveries in the Ashes, whereas he was scoring boundary after boundary in this particular Test match. on those same sort of deliveries. So, I mean, there is some growth over there. There is some improvement. And I feel like, you know, the world is sleeping on Ben Duckett. If you're averaging 41 plus after 22 test matches playing Baz ball cricket, I feel like there's something to that.
I'm not sure if the world's sleeping on him. I just think it's like the world doesn't feel they get enough opportunity to play test cricket. And therefore, people aren't talking about it as much. It's like the whole test cricket issue is a death cycle for the format, right? Because if you're not playing it, cricket is such at the moment, there is so much cricket going on at any one time. Something else is coming in to fill that hole, right? So if your team aren't playing test cricket, it means they're either playing ODI cricket or more likely T20 cricket, or there's some sort of domestic T20 franchise that you're watching. And because of that, I think it is the oxygen is slowly fading out of the test cricket format. Sorry, if you're a big test cricket fan, I've not got much great news for you, I don't think.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence.
Yeah, no, I think Mash and I from the Caribbean Cricket Podcast did a podcast on this very topic, the future of test cricket and the disparity of test cricket and if there are any potential solutions. I think that was back when I was with Grassroots Cricket. So I'm just name dropping different podcasts for all of you guys to watch after this one. But stay here with us for this one for now. And let's talk about the player of the match, right? Ollie Pope, he scored 121 and 51 in this test match. And as good a knock as that first one was, of course, he was playing brilliantly. And there was a time where England, at the start of the test match, scored, 50 in 26 balls, which was also a record. It was the fastest ever 50 in test cricket or team to get to 50. But Pope was timing it really sweetly. The only caveat is that he was dropped twice by the West Indies in the innings where he scored a ton. And the West Indies dropped 5 catches in total, 4 in the first innings. That also played a huge role in this test match.
Yeah, I mean, if they catch those catches and maybe restricting them to under 400, or restricting them to fewer runs, I forgot what the one situation was, then that totally changes the context of the game, right? Actually, you know, West Indies first innings when they the second innings or their first time batting, they looked really good and really in control of the game. It's those, you know, we talked about the ebbs and flows of the game. It's the catches are the ebbs and the flows, right? You've got to build momentum as well. You've got to kind of create doubt in your mind. But the whole thing about baseball is empowering players to go out and play their best game. If you can get into their minds that we are going to get your wicket, we're all on top of you, then that's how you build pressure and it all kind of falls apart. That, you know, the best team at doing that in the world is Australia, right? That's what they do. They will stifle you and keep turning the pressure and turning the pressure and turning the pressure on. The West Indies
Australia,
weren't able to do that.
Pat Cummins Australia is really pragmatic, I feel, and it's the anti-Baz ball at times, and it was a great Ashes that we witnessed. Probably a lot of people called it the best Ashes since 2005. I don't think I'm too displeased with that comment. I feel like it was very, very entertaining. But coming back to the drop catches, right, if you were dropping 5 in a game and 4 in an innings, like had you caught like 2 of those 4, dismissed Pope early, perhaps England would have folded for, I don't know, 316 rather than 416, and then you have a stronger lead and it's a different game altogether. Of course, hindsight is 2020, but still, a lead of 141 is a bit imposing even for baseball, and the game could have flipped that way if they could have gotten England under pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. It just goes back to the West Indies just weren't used to playing in these conditions, right? I was going to say they weren't here that long. Actually, they've been in the UK for quite a while preparing for it, but they're not used to playing at the top level. So the boys are having to make quite a big jump into it. And maybe that could be the difference in this game. We don't really know how good these West Indian players could actually be in this format, which is, you know, I think that's a great tragedy of the whole thing, right?
I do appreciate that there are still some players coming up and, you know, doing their bits, like the Shamar Joseph story in Australia was a big one, even though, look, judging by his fitness in this particular series, I feel like he might not just be ready to play rigorous test cricket day in and day out. He did only bowl 14 overs in between the Lord's test and the Gabba test. So that doesn't like make for good reading. But then again, there were other stories. Of course, England dropped 2 catches as well in this game. And the first one was by Joe Root, where he dropped Gavin Hodge when I think he was on 16. I might be wrong, but it was early days in Hodge's innings. He went on to score 120 runs for the West Indies, essential in them getting to 457. And he pulled the ball really, really well. I loved his pull shots, right? How impressed were you by him?
Oh, for me, look, he was the most valuable player this match, right? Because he's the one who kind of makes the game. Without that invaluable innings, you don't really know where the West Indies finish because you kind of feel like they've got players who can bat, but they're quite fragile. So when we saw it in the final innings where one wicket falls, then it tends to be a bit of a waterfall of wickets. Hodge held that innings together, built on it, and then went and scored a massive amount of runs himself. Without him, we're having a very different conversation. Without that one particular innings, this is a totally different conversation. It's possible that innings also could mean that when the West Indies do come back to England, they still get three test matches. I'm not sure if that will happen or not, but that, you know, that's how important I think that innings could be.
It was also a joy to watch. He's a very fun character as well. It's a great shame that Jared's not here for the Gavin Hodge overthrows episode because he knows him personally. He's his buddy. And I think there's a picture somewhere of Jared's son, Ezekiel, putting his finger in Gavin Hodge's ear. So there were some great stories that we could have shared with you. Maybe Hodge gets another ton and we'll be talking about him next week as well. But he wasn't the only performer for the West Indies with the bat. Alec Athanase and Joshua De Silva scored 82 each in the first innings as well. And that was also really, really important for the West Indies in order for them to post a lead of 41. Let's talk about Athanase first. Here's a guy who I liked the first time I saw him versus India in that test series last year, I believe. And what was particularly impressive about him in this game was his strength through the covers. His cover drives were really something.
Yeah, absolutely. Superb driver off the ball. He looks like he could, you know, again, you just want to see him play more test cricket, right? More in this format. It's interesting because I always think him and I've seen Josh De Silva a few times in England now. Oh, they both look like they're kind of made to play in English conditions a little bit, I feel, which is obviously quite counterintuitive to their backgrounds. And also all the whole conversation about West Indies not being exposed enough to these conditions. If I can talk about them together as well, they also seem to me to be two players who were smart enough to kind of play and adapt to the situation. When it was, we're chasing down a total two, we are building a total. They were they were key in figuring those roles out.
Yeah, absolutely. Josh De Silva in particular, I've always liked him, right? I feel like he maybe started his test career a bit too early. He's still 26, by the way, and we've been seeing him for quite a while. I feel like he was even there in the COVID series, which was 4 years ago. So that means he was 22 back then. He was unbeaten on 82. I was a bit gutted for him because that over by Mark Wood that Shamar was facing was also hilarious. Gavin Hodge also made an interesting statement, right, with respect to facing Mark Wood, of how he told him that he has a wife and kids.
So, yeah
I like that stuff. But that 71-run stand between Joshua De Silva and Shamar Joseph for the last wicket, that was kind of, you know, the best phase of this game for a neutral viewer, I believe. Shamar even broke the roof in one of the stands. That was fun to watch. And what a counterattack it was. Josh De Silva in particular showed how he can change gears. And that over in which he completely butchered Joe Root, right? That was what essentially got the West Indies a lead of 41 runs because it was hovering around 11, 10. And before that, they were even like at a small deficit. But I feel like that partnership really changed things for the West Indies. And for me personally, it was the most enjoyable phase of the game.
Yeah, I think I'd probably agree with that because that's the bit where you're kind of thinking, oh, there's life in this team. Yeah, they're like, they know what they do. They've got gears. It was brilliant to watch. And you also kind of felt there's a game on now.
Yeah.
Because what you didn't want is for the West Indies to get about 350. And you're like, oh, that's kind of a decent total. But then England to come and, you know, smash home another 400 odd runs, which I suppose they did. And then for the West Indies to kind of fall apart. There was a long time in this game. There was a long part of this game where you thought the West Indies are in it all the way into, you know, the West Indies having to lose about three or four wickets in that final innings before you think, all right, this is probably not going to happen.
For me, it was the third innings partnership between Pope and Duckett that killed the game. I kind of knew it was over then at that point. But up until like lunch on day three, this was a very, very interesting, compelling game of Test cricket. And it was a batting track, of course, but we've spoken about the batting enough now. Let's go to the bowling, right? The West Indies were well below par. There are no two ways about that. However, Jaden Seals did pick up 6 wickets in this game. That includes a 4 for 97 in the second innings. And he's had some valuable or a valuable county cricket stint as well, which I feel like has helped him. But apart from Jaden Seals, the visitors weren't really up to the mark with the ball.
I think there's a massive lesson to be learned here for English cricket. And that's, at some point, people will stop going to Test cricket because it's not competitive. Because unless Australia or India here, England are just smashing every other team. Maybe Pakistan might be competitive as well. But at some point, everyone else is going to kind of stop being competitive. The lesson has got to be that they need to get among their opposition team and go, you guys, we know if it's New Zealand, if it's Sri Lanka, if it's the West Indies, if it's Zimbabwe, if it's whoever, we know you guys are coming over later in the summer. Come over in April, spend 2 or 3, or send your bowlers over in April.
Yeah.
Spend 2 or 3 months. They don't even have to play county cricket. They could just play really good Yorkshire League, Lancashire League, Middlesex League, Surrey League
but
cricket.
You can tell,
and just get
right?
used to the conditions.
Seals got a 4 in the first game as well, and then now he's gotten 6 wickets in this game. So him having that county championship experience definitely helps, and I completely agree with you. Like, they're unlucky. Kemar Roach is injured, right? He would have provided more control. But that should be the way forward for teams who are touring England. Somehow get your bowlers a county stint and reimburse them for the franchise cricket that they might be missing, because I can't really think of any other way, right?
Increasingly, for the Test cricket bowlers aren't really playing that much franchise cricket, right? So in some of the more established teams outside the big three, they've still got a kind of stable of kind of 5 or 6 players that are still trying to kind of, you know, play red ball cricket and are focusing more on that red ball stuff. So I don't think there's any reason why they can't bring them over and get them used to the conditions, because ultimately it's in everyone's interest for the sport that games are competitive, right? If you have games, if you have Test cricket matches that are finishing inside 3 days or, you know, by an innings defeat or whatever, it's awful. It's dreadful for everyone. You need to get to a situation where you need to be guaranteed or as close to as many games being won with one side taking 20 wickets, right? Or both sides taking 20 wickets. That's what I mean to say. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. Maybe I'll call you on for a podcast on the health of Test cricket someday, because clearly that's all you want to talk about.
It's not all I want to talk about. I just think it's really difficult to look at this game and this series without looking at it through that prism, right? In years gone by, when we had the great West Indian side, most of their bowlers were playing English cricket, like almost through every English season. That's why when they turned up at the Oval, turned up at Lords, or turned up at Trent Bridge, they knew what to expect. They knew what the ball was going to do. They had plans to bowl at the batsman that they'd bowled at several times before. It's everyone's responsibility for Test cricket to be in a healthy situation. And I think also it's a bit disingenuous to the West Indian players to talk about, oh yeah, so-and-so, they didn't have the best series, when actually these guys have basically been set up to fail.
That's true. No, I concur 100%. And I will at some point schedule this podcast with you. It'll be in the future, so you guys can, you know, look forward to it. Anyway, let's come to England's bowling. Shoaib Bashir took 7 wickets in the game, including 5 for 41 in the second innings. And there has been a lot of scrutiny over his selection mark and how he was preferred over Jack Leach, basically, who is Somerset's first choice spinner. So, I mean, I watched him bowl in the first innings. I didn't catch the second innings live. I caught highlights of the second innings, and it did look like a decent fifer. But in the first innings, there were times where he would get his line really wrong and would bowl some hit-me deliveries as well. And the West Indies were certainly taking him on. I'm not sure where I stand on him. Of course, him being a tall spinner helps, and the release points are something that Bazball or the stakeholders, major stakeholders of Bazball, Stokes and McCullum, they really obsess over. And they're obviously thinking about the Ashes in 18 months' time, which they've said like 10 billion times already. So maybe they're prepping Bash for that. But he's an interesting one, isn't he? When you look at him, he doesn't look like he's exceptional or out of this world. But then he's ended up with 7 wickets in this game, including a fifer. So if you're Shoaib Bashir, you'd be happy.
Yeah. What an interesting career he's having, right? He's 20 years old now. He's not even, as you mentioned, you know, I just want to know what Jack Leach thinks as well. Mm. Like, he's the main guy at Somerset, but then his understudy is the main guy at England, right?
Yeah.
It could potentially be a great documentary or movie somewhere down the line if they kind of keep carrying on and on along this trajectory. Yeah. It's interesting as well because, you know, you can see him learning on the job, right? As you say, he doesn't necessarily hit the line of length he's looking for every single time. So I do wonder where this is heading to. At some point, might be see them when it if it stays as dry as it is and as hot as it is, might they end up playing two spinners somewhere down the line in England?
They will be playing both of those guys in Pakistan, right? They basically hinted at Leach coming back on the side. So we'll see. It's interesting, though, that he has been chosen as the designated, you know, lone spinner in English conditions. Maybe at the Oval someday they're tempted, right, to play two spinners. That's the ground I would be thinking about.
Yeah. They've got a test against Sri Lanka later on this summer at the Oval. So maybe. And that I think that's the third test. So I'd assume probably the series would be potentially done by then as well. So maybe that's when they make they experiment a little bit. England doesn't necessarily produce a lot of great spinners, right? And I kind of always felt with the kind of English cricket setup, they're only ever looking for one spinner at any one time, right? And quite frequently what you've seen is every few years they'll go and chuck a whole batch in, or when they go to Asia, they'll take kind of four spinners with them. And then inevitably, only one of them gets a shot. I think we saw this when Bash went to India as well, right?
Yeah.
And then, it kind of feels you come back to England, it kind of feels everyone else fades away. And actually, you know, I won't mention names, but I've spoken to a few of those spinners in the past who've ended up kind of going along on various tours, and it always leaves them with a bit of taste in their mouth. Because I think if you're an English spinner, I think there's a feeling that there's not enough coaching for you. They don't really know, you know, typically English coaches don't necessarily know how to use you or what to do or you know, the best way to deploy you. So I'm interested to see what happens with Bash, because this all could be, you know, England is littered with spinners who kind of played five or six series and then over kind of two or three years, and you never hear from them ever again. Right?
Dom Best. Think of Dom Best. I don't even think he's playing like in the first division or whatever, in a first string team anymore, right? He's literally fallen off the radar like that. And that has been a trend with English spinners. Some of them just retire early, like Zafar Ansari, and pursue a career in law or whatever. But Bash seems to be someone who they want to stick with in the long run. And he's repaying the faith as is, like in the short term. So let's see how that career unfolds. We'll all be keeping a keen eye on it. As far as England seamers were concerned, not really a good performance at all. The Atkinson bubble kind of burst as well after the Lord's performance. But Chris Wokes, who was, you know, completely out of rhythm at Lords, he did well in this test match, took six wickets, including four for 84 in the first innings. Do you reckon he's done enough here to validate his spot in the team?
I'm really interested to see how this all develops. I think so. He always seems to be the man they turn to when they're not really sure what to do, right? It's like,
he was their player of the Ashes as well. Remember, he came into the side and they started winning.
But it's like, I always feel like somebody at the ECB's deleted his number till they need him again, right? You never, and if he comes and he doesn't do well, he seems to be dropped. He's in the squad at the moment. He's picking up wickets. I mean, I think Wood was unbelievable at points during it as well. So I'm not worried about England's seam stocks at this point. I kind of think what they're trying to do is, again, get this stable together and kind of, when the Ashes rolls around, pick out who they think is going to be the best one. I'd love to know what Jimmy was thinking at home watching this test.
He wasn't at home, right? He was in the dugout. He's the mentor.
Yeah. Sorry. In the dugout, thinking I could have easily got Broken Warne's record.
Maybe.
I don't know. He'll never admit
I mean, he wouldn't admit that, but he would have not retired had they not asked him to. And I mean, Jared and I were talking about this the other day, that they could have just told him that, hey, we'll play you one test match per series and let's see how long you can go. Because he's still Jimmy Anderson at the end of the day, right? I mean, yes, it was time to move on, but you could kind of move on with him in the squad. There were other ways to do this. But I mean, Wokes was supposed to be the heir to Jimmy, and now it looks like Wokes is also reaching the end of his career. But what he provides England with is, you know, balance, because he can bat pretty well. So I feel like as far as England playing in England is concerned, he's always going to be part of the conversation in the short term, or at least for the next couple of years, right? I don't think they're going to play him away, which is why I feel like they probably need to give Pennington a go in the last test match. Just check him out, see where he's at. And you've already won the series. The West Indies are a fairly weaker side than England. So I think might as well take a punt on Pennington as well to get a full picture. That's what I would do. But finally, Mark, one final question on the England versus West Indies test match. Ben Stokes had scored 5 consecutive scores, which were in single digits in test cricket in the build-up to this test match, right? He scored 69 to break the drought. He's pain-free now, but we still haven't really seen the best of him in this series. Do you feel like we will be entertained in Birmingham?
I like to think so. You like to think that he's got a big innings round the corner any one time. I'm not worried about his form. I don't think that's an issue. I think he wears the captaincy quite well. I don't get the impression it weighs him down at all. He's pain-free. You never really know what that means with professional athletes, though, right? Mm. And also, the other thing is it takes a while once you come back from injuries, and he's had the strangest kind of comeback from injury as well, because you kind of, every time I see him bowl, I always think, like, why are you bowling? Like, just don't do this to yourself, man.
Especially when he's bowling those 8 and 9 over spells. I'm like, spells. Dude,
yeah.
This game is won. Don't do this to your body.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, no, nothing more than 3 overs, man. Like, yeah. Like, and even that, I would say it was a pitch. Because you don't, like, he'll need to, it's going to take him a little while to get used to being pain-free, as it were, and finding his body and finding his rhythm. At the moment, whatever he's contributing is enough to win, so it's not really an issue. Yeah. But I think, obviously, you can tell from the way they're talking, the plan is to make sure he's fully fit for the Ashes, right? Yeah. Which feels, you know, there'll be a lot of cricket to play between now and then. But he's got to have that target, what we're talking about, 16 months away now. So he's got to have mind to kind of work towards and get to. So I think that's all. It's all working towards that. I just hope he doesn't push himself and break down.
Same. He is one of my favorite cricketers to watch play, right? And I love every aspect of his game, whether it be his hard-hitting batting or his clutchness or his bowling, fielding, captaincy, everything. So I really hope that he takes care of himself, because he seems like the sort of guy who'll just push himself to the brink and go full tilt every time he gets an opportunity. So I hope he just takes a back seat for a while, and you don't have to bowl those long spells, Stokesy. Anyway, that wraps up our discourse on the England and West Indies test match. We'll be back after a short break with some women's cricket conversations, and you guys are watching Overthrows with Behram and Mark Machado. And Shubo, this is the point where you play the sad, which we will be back right after.
Sometimes you just need to take the slips out and bowl defensively. And you also need to be careful with your computer's defense as well. If you need a VPN, go Nord. NordVPN.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. So put in some dot balls and turn them into maidens via NordVPN.com/Kimber.
Welcome back to Overthrows. You guys are with Mark and Behram, and we have a lot of women's cricket to talk about, because England just recently swept New Zealand in a T20I series, won it 5-0, and then there is an Asia Cup, which is also underway. I know you're dying to talk about Sri Lanka, Mark, but let's just quickly wrap up the England-New Zealand game, right? We've covered all the 4 games prior, so there's only one game we really need to talk about. And throughout this last year, not just this series, England also toured New Zealand earlier, their spinners have basically annihilated the White Ferns, right? Like Sarah Glenn, Charlie Dean, Sophie Eccleston, they have been all over the White Ferns. And this game was a bit different. Lauren Bell was the pick of the bowlers. She's a right-arm seamer. She stood up with 3 for 21. And she's still 23 years of age. And given that spin attack, you know, having her in your arsenal, someone who has built a bit of a reputation for herself, that's a really, really strong bowling attack.
Yeah, absolutely. She's like well on course to being one of the great seamers in kind of English women's cricket, right? I think I might have been at her England debut which I feel was about 4 years ago, but it couldn't have been because that would be in the middle of COVID. And what's really kind of interesting about her career as well is that I don't think she came from a kind of traditional kind of cricketing background. I think she's a little bit like Jimmy, from a kind of like very kind of working class background as well. But when you see her bowl, it looks absolutely brilliant, doesn't it? And she's tall, and that release point's really high as well. And it's
she's got a fan club, man. I see edits of Lauren Bell on Twitter all the time.
yeah. Though, you know, I do find some elements of that fan club to be a bit weird, but that's probably my problem, not theirs. And you know, actually, this England team, their bowling attack is quite fierce, right? Because you're like Sophie Eccleston, you know, she turns that ball as much as anyone in cricket does. Sophie Glenn, again, another, you know, they've got so much talent. And there's other players who aren't in the side. And every time I look at them, I'm like, why didn't they make it? Why aren't they in the squad? And then you're like, oh, well, it's because these players are better than them, right? So they've not just built a strong 11. They're built, like, I feel like there's a really good 19 players they need to
do. They bat really deep, different batters, you know, raise their hands up at different times. I have had this recent hot take, that for me, the favorites in Bangladesh in, what is it, October? The T20 World Cup. It's probably one of India or England. I'm actually liking those teams more than Australia right now. So you guys can hold me on to that one and maybe ridicule me when Australia do win it at the end. But on the other hand, you have New Zealand, who have been like completely below par. And for a while now, I felt like Pakistan competed better with England in the summer. And there's not much to write home about, honestly. They're overly dependent on Amelia Kerr, Susie Bates and Sophie Devine. And maybe there is one positive that's come out for them in this game, is that the 20-year-old slow left-armer, Fran Jonas, she was the best bowler on the day. She took 4 for 22 career best figures. And given that the T20 World Cup is going to be in Bangladesh, maybe that's a good sign. But there's not much else going right for them currently.
No, I kind of think that New Zealand, one of the early adopters of, you know, they really went seriously into kind of professional women's cricket. They played a lot quite early on. I think some of the other teams have kind of started to catch up with them. You know, that they've there's just a lot more international women's cricket being played at the moment, right? So a lot of the South Asian teams are playing a lot more cricket than they ever have. And I think that's maybe what's happened in the New Zealand situation. I think it used to be a case where if you had kind of one or two outstanding international female players, you'd be all right in international women's cricket, and you'd win enough for no one to kind of notice or to pave over some of your errors. But now, actually, as teams become more professional and there's more money getting into it, the kind of standard of international cricket around the world's slowly rising in the women's game. And because of that, I think New Zealand are kind of getting left behind a little bit. And they've got to, like they did with the men's side, they've got to go away and rethink about how we're producing players, what do we need to produce, how do we get the best out of the pool of players that we've got, which is a challenge, right? But that's a challenge every team has, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, they were a very, very solid team for quite a while, and now they're just overly dependent on a few players. And I feel like in the pecking order of competitive teams within women's cricket, which is, you know, ever increasing pretty much daily, they have really slipped behind, and this is not a good sign. So let's hope that Fran Jonas can, you know, muster up some of those spells in the World Cup as well, some fourfers, and maybe that'll help them. But anyway,
you've got to be really worried for them in Bangladesh, right?
Yes.
Like, really worried for them, because those conditions are not favorable to the kind of team that they're not at all at the moment.
Not in the slightest. So yeah, let's see how they progress as a unit. Anyway, I won't keep you waiting for much longer. Let's talk about the Asia Cup. And let's start with Sri Lanka as well. Unbeaten thus far, right? They have defeated Malaysia and who was it? The UAE?
Bangladesh.
Sorry.
Our nearest and dearest rivals. Not nearest, yes. But our dearest rivals.
Absolutely. And Chamari Attapattu scored 119 runs, has become the only full member nation player in T20 cricket to a women's T20 cricket to score 3 tons. This was her career best, 119. She is the GOAT of Sri Lankan cricket, pretty much the best Sri Lankan cricketer right now across both men and women's teams. And yeah, I mean, as long as you guys have got her, Sri Lanka will always remain an extremely competitive side. But what's even more promising, Mark, is that youngsters are starting to rise to the occasion. I've been impressed with Vishmi Gunaratne. She's had some really good scores off late. And just in the Bangladesh game, she scored a very valuable half century as well. So it's not an entirely dependent team on Chamari right now anymore. And some of the bowlers are doing well as well. I feel like if there's any one team which could give India a run for their money in this Asia Cup, it's got to be Sri Lanka.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it wasn't that long ago. Jared was having conversations with Estelle about where have the Sri Lanka team gone, where have the women's team gone. You can ask the same question about the men in some ways. You know, what's happened to Sri Lanka women's cricket? And in the last kind of 18 months, 2 years, they've kind of just exploded. I've got to give somewhat begrudgingly some credit to SLC because actually they've created a bit for a system. The conversation me and Estelle used to always have whenever any squad came out with new players and would be like, where have these players come from? Because then when there was no visibility to the women's game at all, Sri Lanka cricket start to put domestic tournaments in. They've got a kind of strategy for the under 19s and for the younger age groups where they're going out into more rural areas to look for players. There is obviously a lot of young girls in Sri Lanka who like playing cricket and want to play cricket. And over the last kind of 18 months or so, we've seen that develop. We were finalists the last Asia Cup where we lost to India in the final against Bangladesh.
Yes.
I think if you're a Sri Lanka fan, I think it's absolutely acceptable to say that anything other than getting to a final would be seen as a failure this time around, because A, it's at home, and B, as you said, it's not just about Chamari. What I really want to say, because I know this isn't the show that only Sri Lanka fans listen to, like my own show, The Early End. I know this is a show that a lot of people from around the world listen to. What I really want to say is don't worry about Sri Lanka cricket. Don't worry about a women's team. We ain't doing anything. Get Chamari out, and that's it. Yeah. But actually, that's really not true. And Chamari herself is saying it now. She's like, well, I think today against Malaysia, she didn't even have to bowl.
Even versus South Africa, she didn't score very many runs, but they got results, right? So other youngsters are stepping up. And obviously, having Chamari over there as this role model helps. And there is a new generation being blooded under her, you know, shadow and umbrella. And I feel like she is such a behemoth of Sri Lankan cricket at this point that as long as she sticks around, she could really develop a golden generation of women's cricketers in Sri Lanka. We're already seeing some amazing results already. And you are absolutely right to say that them not making the final would or should be seen as a failure at this point because they are that good. And maybe not a lot of people have realized it, but I feel like in this new competitive age of women's cricket, they're knocking high up on the door.
Yeah, I mean, the last, 18 months or so, we beat New Zealand at a T20 series. We beat England in England in the T20 series. We've beaten South Africa in the T20 series. And now we're at the Asia Cup. Then after that, we'll go to Ireland. And then it's full kind of World Cup. There'll be some warm-up games. If you're a Sri Lanka fan, this is a very exciting time to be watching women's cricket. We're seeing, because obviously on the Murali end, we do women's content, we do men's content. We're slowly seeing people are taking more and more interest in what the women are doing. It's interesting what you said about Chamari bringing through the next generation. Because a lot of the conversation around her is about how long will she play for. I think she's 34 now. And she's been in the team. I think it feels to me since she was about 12. That's not quite right. I think she debuted in 2011, but it's a heck of a long time. There is a kind of fear that she might retire from T20 cricket, but effectively that's all, you know, they play T20 and ODI cricket. She might retire after the World Cup. Interestingly, during the interval in the game today, the coach was talking about trying to keep her on to play for another 3 or 4 years, which would be amazing. Because I think you're right to point out, it's about her teaching the youngsters how to be professionals, yeah, right? There is a absolutely degree of like, how do you be a professional sports person? There's so many things that if you're a 22-year-old and you're a pro sports person, this isn't just cricket. It means that you can't stay up late and go out with your mates on a random Tuesday night. You've got to a degree, you watch your diet, make sure you do exercise. You know, it's not just turning up for training. There's so much more than that. And a lot of people I've spoken to who've worked with Charmri have said she's just the ultimate pro. Like,
absolutely. She looks like a thorough professional as well. I'm glad she's getting franchise gigs as well now on the regular. And if you look at the South Africa tour, right? Take that one game out in which she completely blew the opposition away. Apart from that, it was the youngsters stepping up for the most part, which is the most promising element within Sri Lankan women's cricket for me right now. And it's an exciting team to follow, of course. So let's see whether or not they make it to the final. But I have a strong hunch that not only can they make the final, but on their day, they could be champions of Asia. So let's see. And best of luck to both you and all the Sri Lankan fans watching this. Let's come to India, of course, who are red-hot favourites to obviously lift the title. Smriti Mandhana has been in incredible form. I think her and Hayley Matthews have gone on this run this year, which is very, very hard to replicate. They're getting scores in every goddamn game. And Smriti and Shefali, who is another person or batter who's in incredible form, they downed Pakistan in a jiffy, right? And then we saw them, or India, score 200+ versus the UAE. And that was a game in which Harmanpreet Kaur, one of the finest T20 batters to come out of India, she scored 66. And Richa Ghosh, who I think, as far as power hitters are concerned, is right up with the very best, right, in contemporary women's cricket. She scored 64 off 29 or something. India's bowling is also, you know, very, very good. They've got Pooja Vastrakar, who's in form. They've got Radha Yadav, the slow left-armer. Shreyanka Patil is injured now, but they have enough strength on the bench to make up for her. This team has to win something soon, which is not the Asia Cup, but the Asia Cup would be a good stepping stone for them to kind of prime themselves to lift the title or T20 World Cup title in Bangladesh later this year.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, you know, we talked about Charmri teaching people how to be professionals in India. They've gone to the next level, right? Yeah. These girls are full-time, earning really good money. We're seeing a bit of competition for places now as well, and we're seeing the impact that's having on the team. When we talked about the England and West Indies series, we talked about how the West Indies don't really have the opportunity to develop themselves as red ball players. In India, we've got the kind of inverse problem where there's a fear that they're going to just like move further and further away from everyone else, right? Because they you know, there's now so much attention on the women's players, and every time I see them play, they look better and better and better. Hmm. I mean, you didn't even mention Jemima Rodriguez, who, like,
I didn't.
To me, she's there. Sometimes I see her bat and it's like they've pulled her out for a cricket AI or something, right? Because she's so orthodox and so textbook in some of her shots.
There's also Asha Sobhana, who is a senior player, right? Not senior in terms of game time, but she's quite old. She's the oldest debutant to debut for India, I think. And she's been in amazing form in the build up to this Asia Cup as well. So there's so many of these players who are coming up and rising to the occasion. And India, I feel, are on the brink of being one of the most powerful women's teams of all time. But they're not quite there yet. And this T20 World Cup could be that time. I mean, I expect them to win the Asia Cup. Like, it would be an upset if they don't, right? And in Bangladesh conditions, you've got to say that they would be extremely difficult to defeat.
Yeah, absolutely. When you talk about what you want for your composition or for a T20 batting lineup, this women's side absolutely has it, right? Because you have to go to about 8 wickets down before you, like, that person couldn't rebuild an innings by themselves. So if they can bat really deep, and that even if you go and get 3 or 4 wickets early on, you're like, this middle order is still absolutely dangerous. It's a really interesting side. I think it's really interesting what will happen in Bangladesh, because I think that, you know, the other big favourite for this would be England. I'm not sure how much cricket those girls would have played in Bangladesh and those which I assume will be very, very spin-friendly conditions. Yeah. I always think whenever there's any cricket to be played in Bangladesh, it's all about who can adapt to it better, right? And who can adapt to it quickest. Presumably, you'd feel that the Indian players might have a slight advantage because they're probably slightly more used to that kind of temperature and conditions. I also do think it's worth talking about. Bangladesh pitches seem to play like no other pitches in the world, right? It's like, So I think that's the only kind of mystery here. I mean, yeah, it's difficult to see how India don't end up kind of topping or winning this Asia Cup. And I'm the most optimistic Sri Lanka fan in the world. and then you think they use that momentum and roll on to the World Cup, right?
It's looking ominous in terms of, you know, I mean, if you're an Indian fan, it looks amazing. And I think this is a time to be extremely excited about the women's team. And I've felt this for a number of years now that India are very, very close to being the best in the format. I feel like that gulf is narrowed even further and they're not too far away. But let's see. I have India and England as my two favorites for the T20 World Cup final. I know Australian fans will not enjoy that take. And maybe Australia will go on and win this, right? But they've been losing the odd game here and there. So let's see. It'll be interesting. Coming on to Pakistan, got hammered by India. You expect that almost, right? Because in the gulf between both those two sides is massive. And Pakistan have seen some retirements off late as well. Bisma Maruf has, of course, hung her boots. And Javeria Khan, even though she wasn't part of the team recently, has followed suit. But there was one promising sign, right? Gul Firoza scored 57 of 35 versus Nepal. And they've stuck with her for a bit. She's repaid the faith. I like the way Pakistan's batters are playing in the power play. I feel like there's something there. I just feel like there's a bit of dearth in quality over here. But if you nurture this lot of or group of cricketers correctly, because there's a lot of youngsters in there, you could make something out of it. They did win in New Zealand not too long ago, right? And you see them competing well in games, but there are phases in which they completely lose it.
They're definitely playing a lot more cricket than they were not that long ago, right? And I think there's lots of lessons to learn from the way Sri Lanka rebuilt their women's team. Keep the same squad, or, you know, keep a squad together, have faith in them and believe in the players and install real belief. The two kind of teams we've talked about a lot this, you know, in the last 58 minutes have been England and Sri Lanka, and they're in Sri Lanka women's side, and both of them have kind of very similar ideas in terms of, you know, baseball. I mean, Sri Lanka aren't playing baseball, but that, you know, they back their players. That's like the most important thing, right? And that's what you kind of feel Pakistan needs to do: back their players, build out a bit more domestically, so there's a bit more depth to it, and then you might at some point be able to kind of cycle new players into it and rebuild the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Some other performances from the Asia Cup worth mentioning were Nepal's victory over the UAE saw Samjana Khadka, who had scored 63 runs in a T20 career, right? She scored 72 of 45 unbeaten, so that was a fantastic effort. And also, I don't know what happened with the Bangladesh game, which was happening right now, actually. So let me just quickly go to Crick Info, see what went down over there. So Bangladesh have defeated Thailand. Thailand scored 96 for 9 and Bangladesh chased it down in 17 and a half overs. And key performers for them were Murshida Khatun, who scored a 50. And then also Rabia Khan, who scored, or well, didn't score. She took 4 for 14. She is a leg break bowler and she's been doing well recently as well. With respect to Bangladesh, sure, a home T20 World Cup is coming up. But I don't know, like, who's the stronger team, them or Pakistan right now?
I think Pakistan are probably the stronger team. This Asia Cup, like, even though my team are doing well, I think there was a bit of sadness in, it feels to me like the gulf between the test nations and the non-test nations, it feels like it's going the wrong way. Obviously, you know, Nepal seemed to me like, I think the thing we've all discovered, if we didn't know it already, is that cricket is really popular in Nepal. And the Nepalese seemingly love their cricket, and maybe not everyone in the world knew that. Thailand and Malaysia and even the UAE are probably, feels to me like they're not as competitive as they used to be. And I think that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, undoubtedly. But if you think about the Women's Asia Cup, I feel like it's got more prestige than the Men's Asia Cup at this point, because the Men's Asia Cup is always so random and there is no set format for it. Whereas the Women's Asia Cup has become a bit of a thing and is closer to what you would expect the Euros to be if they were a cricket thing. The Men's Asia Cup just never really got there.
I quite like the Men's Asia Cup.
You think so?
Yeah, but like mainly because of politics. I think if you're a Sri Lanka fan or a Bangladesh fan, any Asia Cup is always going to be an all right thing, because you're in a decent shot of, you're not going to get caught up in the kind of crossfire between India and Pakistan. So no one notices you till you get to the semi-final or beyond, right? But
I think Sri Lanka have made the final like for each edition of the Asia Cup for, I don't even remember how long at this point, honestly.
Oh, but we do all of that for any sort of win in any sort of ICC event at the moment. I also think I kind of like the pop-up nature of it, of like having it always just before a World Cup. Like, I dislike that.
I actually dislike that, because I feel like teams like Sri Lanka and Pakistan then go full on trying to win it, whereas teams like India will just treat it as prep. I wish it was its own thing and would not happen right before a World Cup or ICC event, because that way you could actually build the Asia Cups brand, which in my eyes is nothing. And it's not even an ICC event, right? It's an ACC event. And the president of the ACC is Jay Shah. So I don't know. I get the monetary value of having it before a World Cup and the preparation value. But I feel like if you want to build the Asia Cup as a brand of its own, it needs to have its own dedicated, you know, biannual cycle or whatever.
They with the women's edition, they have done interesting things with it in the past. They played it in China about 10 years ago, didn't they? But so I kind of could see your argument, but actually, I think if I was a coach, I'd take the Pakistan-Sri Lanka route, right? Because I think winning is habitual, and winning breeds winning. So you want to come out the Asia Cup with a good record, and kind of knowing on the basis that most of them are played about kind of a few weeks before an ICC tournament, right? You want to come out of it knowing who your best 11 or at least kind of your best 13 players are. So that's why I think actually the Asia Cup is kind of invaluable to the teams that play it, and why I think it should probably stay.
On the flip side, you get some of your players get injured trying to go full tilt in the Asia Cup. But anyway, I see your side of the argument
It's professional sport, man. Injuries are injuries, right? They're going to happen. That's the game.
Yeah, Vivek Bhagat in the comments is saying, bring back the Asian Test Championship. Hell yes! I'm totally for that. I enjoyed the Asian Test Championship. But yeah, I mean, let's see what the future of the Asia Cup is going to be. For now, we're going to enjoy this one. And that actually brings an end to all of our talking points for overthrows. We do not have any super chats. So thank you to everyone who joined us in the comments. Yes, a lot of people are asking about Jared as well. He's on vacation. He'll be back next week. That's why we have Mark with us this week. And it's been a pleasure to record Overthrows, of course. And just a quick reminder to everybody who's watching, you guys can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. That can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. We'll be back with another episode of Overthrows next week. That is all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.